13-22-00576-CV in the estate of Deborah Sue Mon, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, deceased.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning again. My name is Dabney Pettis with Welder Leshen Law Firm here in Corpus Christi. I'm here with my associate Paul Mullen, and I failed to introduce him, and I wanted to. He's sitting here with me. And we are counsel for the appellant, Mark Mon, in this case. We are here today, as shown by our briefs, due to the trial court's granting of summary judgment in favor of the appellee in this case. This case, again, arises out of the County Court at Law Number 4 of Nueces County, Texas. The trial court's granting of summary judgment in favor of the appellee was an error. This case should be reversed and remanded back to the trial court. The primary issues that are at issue here today and the points of error are the following. Appellant's due diligence in discovering the breach, which is a question of fact, and was very much improper for summary judgment. Furthermore, we alleged a breach of fiduciary duty claim in the underlying case. The breach of fiduciary claim is tantamount to fraudulent concealment. That is based on Texas Supreme Court law, which again is cited to in our brief, and I can certainly cite it to the court if necessary. Over and over and over again, cases have been held, the Texas Supreme Court has held that questions concerning fraudulent concealment are indeed a question of fact. So, two points of error on appeal. Again, due diligence in discovering the underlying breach is a question of fact and was wholly improper for summary judgment.
However, isn't there also case law that due diligence is decided as a matter of law? I mean, there's a whole case law also about due diligence as a matter of law.
You are correct, Your Honor. There certainly is.
But why is this a fact issue and not a straight, we can decide it straight on the facts that due diligence was not found in this case?
Because I think there's a fact question that,
right,
that purely exists here.
What's the fact question you believe that a jury must decide?
Okay, so the fact question here is the following in this case. The issue is whether or not my client exercised reasonable diligence in determining his sister's, the decedent in this case, breach of fiduciary duty. There is no argument that she did indeed breach her fiduciary duty as the executor of her father's or their father's estate. The issue, of course, is whether or not my client exercised reasonable diligence in discovering that.
Okay, so there's also doesn't seem to be any fact issues based on the discovery in front of the trial court as to the facts of how it occurred, of at least in answers to requests for admissions, to interrogatories, and his sworn statement, that he was aware of many of these assets back in the 70s, if my dates are correct. And there's a lot of dates because we're talking about 30 years.
It was after 1987, Your Honor, okay, which is when the decedent in the underlying case was appointed as the independent executor of her father's estate. But in any event, you are correct. There's a line of cases. But I fully believe that there is a fact question here. And I want to really hone in on this fact. It is true. Nobody is asserting that this is not true. My client did admit in a deposition that he knew of certain assets that existed. But to say that one knows of assets that exist and they should therefore automatically know that the assets were being misappropriated or that income therefrom was being misappropriated, mishandled, and that the decedent was depositing it into her own personal bank account, he had no knowledge of. So the mere existence of an asset does not equate to my client knowing that it was being misappropriated or fraudulently dealt with by the executor.
He did know about the duplexes, correct?
He knew about the duplexes, Your Honor.
Did the duplexes ever, change hands or title to those to the beneficiaries of the estate?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, but what is important is the fact that those duplexes were earning income. That is not required to be recorded anywhere. That is not the issue. Is, again, duplexes were earning income. Royalties were producing mineral interest.
What did he think they were doing with the duplexes?
I don't know that, Your Honor, but that is an issue that a jury should hear.
But didn't he have an opportunity then to file an objection to the inventory and appraisement in the probate court?
He had an opportunity, Your Honor, of course, and no one is saying he did not. But I think this case in general turns probate law on its head. The trial court is basically saying that the executor can do whatever she wants, and when asked, you know, she can say basically whatever she wants to a beneficiary, and that it is incumbent upon the beneficiary to take action, and that it is his burden. And I think that is absolutely incorrect, because a fiduciary owes a duty of full disclosure of all material facts at all times. So it's basically saying, executor, you can just do whatever you want to do, and if you say there's nothing left, the beneficiary just has to believe you, and then it's incumbent upon him to go ask questions. You're not saying...
But isn't that the way it normally happens?
No, Your Honor, that's
not... You have to exercise due diligence as a beneficiary or someone interested in the estate to actually do something if you don't believe it's being done correctly?
My client had no cause to believe anything was being done incorrectly.
I think that the argument can be made that he did think there was cause because he was questioning it. And as such, at that point, didn't his due diligence kick in rather than take it at face value? And at that point, that's when the due diligence starts as far as the, and it's been a lot longer than 4 years.
Understood. And I don't disagree that he had the option to do so. The issue becomes whether or not he felt that it was appropriate to do so. And that is what a jury should be hearing.
But that's not what a jury is going to be asked. The jury is going to be asked, did he take due diligence at that time to investigate, to object, to whatever action you think a reasonable person should have done. And that occurred, that should have occurred early on when he was starting to question the, in this case, his sister.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. Because the jury has to hear all of the circumstances. The case law is very specific that all of the circumstances concerning both the defendant, both the plaintiff and the defendant's actions are relevant to this inquiry. So the jury not only has to hear what actions he took, that is true, but the jury absolutely is going to be able to hear what actions she took, the executor, and whether or not she turned around when he said, what's going on, and told him the truth, and fully disclosed the entirety of the estate. The case law is very clear from the Texas Supreme Court in case after case after case that a fiduciary owes a duty of full disclosure to someone.
I agree with you. And if it wasn't for the Berry case, which I wrote and
right.
got reversed by the Texas Supreme Court, in which I believed in that case, we did this court, that there was a discovery and a due diligence. And in that, the Supreme Court was very clear to us. No, he had a duty to go check the records. He had a duty to go do this. And it was very, wasn't a probate, but definitely still fiduciary duties and very clearly misappropriation of funds in that case. And they still did not find in that case that as a matter of law, the statute of limitations had run.
And I understand that, Your Honor. But again, I fully believe that the trial court should be able to hear not only what she did, but what he did. And it's very important to note here that certain things in this estate, especially income, was not discoverable through a public record search, for example. Yes, he knew of the assets, but he didn't know that the income produced therefrom, how it was being used. He didn't even know whether or not it was producing any income. So if she turns around and says, there's nothing left in this estate, he's like, okay, there's nothing left in this estate. And I have no way to fact check her. Other than filing Section 404 demand for an accounting under the estate's code, but that is not reasonable practice in probate law. Again, we're turning probate law on its head. And we're basically saying, executor, you can just say whatever you want. And a beneficiary, you just have to believe them. And if you have a question, yeah, you can go hire an attorney to file a Section 404 demand for an accounting. Sure, but that is not common practice. So we're basically setting precedent, I believe, to go tell all beneficiaries.
It might not be common practice, but isn't that the due diligence that he has if he wants an accounting of what is occurring in the estate? I mean,
if
isn't
he has
that what the statute has set forth?
If he has a question, sure, that is an option. But again, he didn't have any need. He didn't believe that there was a question. He believed his sister when she turned around and said, there's nothing left. There's nothing left to distribute. He was like, okay. He didn't believe in his mind subjectively that there was a necessity to ask any more questions. So again, I think that the jury should be able to hear not only what he believed and what he heard, but what she did, or in this case, failed to do.
Doesn't your entire argument rest on a fraud allegation was not pled?
Your Honor, and that's a very good point as well. It is true that it was not specifically pled, but the case law is very clear that breach of fiduciary duty is tantamount to fraud.
Can be, but a breach of fiduciary duty doesn't always have to be fraudulent, does it?
No, it does not, Your Honor, but in this case it does, and we should allow the jury to determine whether or not it is. So again, we look up tantamount. In Webster's, Oxford English Dictionary, we use the plain language meaning. It means equivalent to. And that is Texas Supreme Court case. That is the SV versus RV case. So it is equal to fraud. Let me rephrase to your point, Your Honor. There are circumstances where it can be equal to fraud. And this is precisely one of those. Because fraud necessitates the duty of full disclosure. Here we do not have a duty. There was no full disclosure. Furthermore, and most importantly, I believe, fraud is inherently undiscoverable. And the case law is very clear on that. That is, again, from the SV Supreme Court case 933 Southwest 2nd Supreme Court. My apologies on the year. 2000. My apologies.
That's okay. We read your brief.
I'm sure you have it, Your Honor. Thank you.
A breach of fiduciary duty can also be through negligence.
Of course.
And something other than fraud.
Of course it can. Absolutely. But here, we believe the jury should determine whether it is tantamount to fraud, and that the same rules should apply. Because clearly in this case, she knowingly failed to disclose all of the income and all of the details concerning the estate administration to her brother when asked. So cases have also said that fraud and breach of fiduciary duty are inherently undiscoverable. And when something is inherently undiscoverable, it tolls the statute of limitations. And a fiduciary is stopped from arguing a statute of limitations defense in this exact type of situation. And I think that is really important here as well. She can't just hide behind 30 years of going, I'm basically going to tell you something that's not true. And then when my client legitimately finds out that he's just completely SOL, I don't think that's good public policy for the state of Texas.
But isn't it also not good public policy to have this ability for probates to continue? There's a whole set of deadlines in the probate because we don't want to be here since 87 discussing an estate that was probated in 1987.
I understand that absolutely, Your Honor, and that is a very good point. And the law, what is the word I'm looking for, likes finality. The law, finality is a good thing in the law. But again, in these types of situations, statute of limitations are told, and they are not a defense. And so, yes, in this type of situation, we should absolutely be able to go back. there was a very serious wrong that occurred here. And I think...
Well, I agree with you, but, you know, when we had the Kennedy King Ranch lawsuits here 18 years ago, that was the issue, the toll. And there was something very wrong in that heirs were excluded from the estate. And again, this court was reversed by the Texas Supreme Court saying, no, we need finality. This matter is concluded. You can't reopen these probate matters 50 years later.
And I understand that, Your Honor, and I respect that. However, in this situation, I think it is absolutely right for this court to remand this back to the trial court and allow the jury to hear all of these facts. And then if the jury decides that based on their full analysis of the inherent breach that occurred, that it truly, that it was discoverable, because that's the issue that's going to be given to the question that's going to be given to the jury is whether or not he exercised reasonable due diligence. Then we're done. We understand that. All we want is the ability to go to a jury on this issue.
Right. Your time has concluded. We'll
thank you very much.
Minute for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Lehrman, and I am counsel for the appellee Betty Ann Koger, independent executor of the estate of Deborah Sumon. And I want to remind the court that I'm representing Betty Ann Koger today. Okay, Betty Ann Koger, just for the court's recollection, is the executor of the estate of the party that we're talking a lot about today, the late Mrs. Mon. And so I want to remind the court of that. Justices, this is a case fundamentally about diligence and how the plaintiff's failure to exercise due diligence in this case bars his recovery against the state. That's what this case is about. What is diligence under Texas law? Well, there's no definition, but let's talk about some key facts that I think are illustrative in this case to provide the court with some guidance. 13,127. That's the amount of days between the date of the death of Mr. Mon Sr. and the date of the filing of this lawsuit. 13,127 days. Okay, that is the length of time that we're talking about here. Justices, we're not talking about a short window. We're not talking about somebody that missed a midnight deadline. We're not talking about someone that missed a two-day deadline, a one-year deadline, a four-year deadline. We're talking about decades and decades that passed for the amount of time that the appellant in this case had the opportunity to do anything with respect to this estate.
But in those 13,000 whatever days you calculated, Mr. Lehrman, your client during all that time period had a fiduciary duty to Mrs. Pettis' client.
She did, and we don't think she violated it, Judge. Okay. And that issue is not before this court, the merits of that. And so I'm going to focus today on the diligence issue. We deny that any breach of fiduciary duty occurred, and we have filed pleadings to that effect. So we feel like there is no breach of fiduciary duty that occurred. But if there was, there was ample opportunity and ample consideration given to Mr. Mon to file anything with respect to that. So I want to talk about some important facts. The first fact is, upon being appointed executor, an inventory, appraisement, and list of claims were filed timely and promptly under the estate's code by Deborah Sumon. That's the first opportunity for Mr. Mon to look at this and say, hey, this doesn't add up. This list, this appraisal, this inventory doesn't include all the assets I know Pop owned. Pop owned more than that. He's his son. In fact, he helped work on some of these ranches, some of these lands that we're on. He had the opportunity at that point. That's his first sign to say, this is wrong. I need to do something about it, and I need to file some type of remedy for that. He didn't do any of that. He had the opportunity to request an accounting if he thought the accounting was wrong, Justice Benavides. He didn't do that. The estate's code provides many different weapons, so to speak, for a challenger to contest an inventory, an appraisal, or the effect of the administration of the estate. There are remedies available to him that he did not exercise. Therefore, he did not exercise due diligence.
Okay, so the remedies of due diligence of what Ms., if I understand correctly, the argument that's being made today is that there was no way to know the breach. For example, let's assume for argument's sakes, since we're not getting into the merits, but the allegation is that there was income, the property is listed, the income is listed, but she's putting it in the wrong account, as was done in the Berry case that was being put in the wrong account. And that the putting into the wrong account is the breach of fiduciary duty. And there's no way to know that in the probate matter.
Well, first of all, he knew his deposition testimony went further than knowledge, justices. He didn't just testify, I knew about these assets. I knew about the ownership. I knew about the land. He knew they were earning income. He testified to such, and it's in the record, that he knew that this farmland was earning income, that the mineral royalty were making payments, that there was duplexes that were earning income, and he wasn't receiving anything. So if he did think that this money was being misappropriated, was being embezzled, was being concealed, he had that knowledge that there were these were income-generating assets, justices. This isn't like he had a Picasso in the safe and the estate administrator sold it to Switzerland, made $1 million, and pocketed it and went to Paris. That's not what we're dealing with today. And I'm not, the facts of Berry are very distinguishable from this case, Judge, but Berry really was about constructive notice and actual notice, in my opinion, among other things. And as you know, writing that opinion, the court found that there was more than just constructive notice, and they talked about that, the difference between actual and constructive. These were not only recorded mineral royalty interests with the Jim Wells County and Brooks County, but they were also earning income and royalties, some of which he received. Some of which he testified in deposition, he actually received income from these. And so he had more than just the opportunity. This isn't a case where she was embezzling money and allegedly, again, I'm trying to stay away from the merits, and he was unaware of it.
That's the problem that occurs, because if we're trying to pinpoint what the allegation is to ascertain when the breach occurred, which is what we're going to start the clock ticking, because it could occur at day one or it could occur on day 13,000, right? So at that time, was there a due diligence as a matter of law, and or is it a fact issue that needs to go to the jury?
Well, first off, I want to address the fact issue question first, if I may.
Yes,
as you pointed out early, what Hooks is really the chief case they rely upon, Hooks v. Sampson. That's an oil and gas dispute between an oil and gas developer and a mineral rights owner. And in the Hooks case, the court very clearly said that there are situations where it's a matter of law. Diligence, I want to be clear, case law is clear, and I think counsel admitted this, that you can find as a matter of law that due diligence was not exercised. And so that is black letter law, and in fact, Hooks says that. And so to answer your question with respect to the due diligence issue, as a matter of law, this court can decide that he failed to exercise what's reasonable due diligence. And the courts provide some guidance on this. If you look
That's what was going to be my follow-up question to Mr. Lerman, as I asked Ms. Pettis. At what point do we move from whether it's a fact issue or a legal issue?
Well, I think the courts provide some guidance on that, Your Honor. And the Court of Appeals have said that discovery rule is a narrow exception that is only applied in rare and exceptional cases. And I want to talk about something, but I'm going to answer your question first. The courts say that a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty generally accrues and limitations begins to run when the claimant knows or should know of the wrongful injury. That's from the Supreme Court in Berry. However, the Supreme Court in that same case also made clear that a legal injury occurs and the clock starts, as you said, begins to run when facts come into existence that authorize a party to seek judicial remedy. What are those facts? Those facts are very clear. There was assets owned by the estate that Mr. Mom was a beneficiary of, specifically mineral interest, duplexes, and farmland that was earning income. And he wasn't receiving that income, Justice Benavides, and he had before. So he had knowledge. The courts are clear. You can't just sit there and say, I trusted my sister. You know, in fact, Berry versus Berry is the most epic family feud of all time. And there's case law after case law in the Kennedy case, which is Frost Bank. Those are epic family feuds. Unfortunately, the families don't always get along, as this court knows. And a lot of lawyers are in business because of family feuds. That's a common, we've all seen that movie before. He was estranged from his sister, Justice Benavides. This is not a situation where this was a loving family that worked together, lived together, did this. No, it's a fact, and it's in the record. He was estranged from his mother and his sister. And so they did not have a good relationship. So if you're estranged from someone that's in charge of the estate, I think as any reasonable person would do, they may have questions over the course of 30 years about why they're not receiving any money. He didn't do anything. He exercised no due diligence. So that is a question of law that the trial court found to be dispositive. The trial court very clearly, if you read his order, he found it was overwhelming evidence. He didn't use the words lightly or close call, justices. He used the words overwhelming because the evidence was that strong. So we feel that this is not a close call, and that he had ample opportunity to know about the date of the breach because he had been receiving income and he'd stopped receiving income. And he knew about all of these assets and he did nothing about it. Now, I want to talk about the failure to plead because Justice Tyrion had brought that up, and I think that's important. I don't know if the appellant goes much farther than that, to be honest with y'all. The reality is Mr. Mon did not plead fraud. The majority of the brief is focused on cases involving fraud and fraudulent concealment. I would submit to the court that this is not one of those cases, first and foremost, because her own pleadings talk about breach of fiduciary duty. So that's the only pled cause of action in Texas, in this case. Now, in Texas, as Justice Tyrion pointed out, there's many more causes of action than just a breach of fiduciary duty. And a breach of fiduciary duty is not synonymous with fraud. Those are very different causes of action. So I don't think
if that breach of fiduciary duty claim was based on some fraudulent act, can you then sneak in the fact issue in the granting of a summary judgment or denial of a summary judgment, saying if there's a fact issue, so we're not going to do it?
I don't think you can. I think even under our broad liberal notice pleading law that we have right under Texas, I still think when you've got a four corners of a pleading where the word fraud is not used as a cause of action, that it's unfair to my client to interpret this cause of action to be an allegation of fraud when it's an allegation of breach of fiduciary duty. So I think there are situations where these claims can be intertwined, but you still got to plead them. And the court's very clear. In fact, under the only way that you can get summary judgment with respect to the discovery rule is if it was pled. And I would submit to the court that in addition to fraud not being pled, you won't find the word discovery rule in the pleading either. Now, we went ahead in our briefing to the trial court and to this court, assumed that the discovery rule was the basis of the defense to limitation. So we briefed that and we've addressed that. But nonetheless, I also think it's telling to this court that discovery rule itself was not pled. I want to talk about the Berry case and the Hooks case, if I can.
Okay.
excuse me?
If you must.
If I must, yes. And, the important part about Hooks is as I mentioned before, in that case, which is really the only case that the appellant cites for the fact that you can decide due diligence as a matter of fact, and it therefore has to be submitted to a jury. First off, again, that's not what that case says. In fact, that case cites to numerous cases where the court has found as a matter of law, due diligence was not met. So that's really important. But it's also, it's also very distinguishable from the case at hand. Again, we're not dealing with the mineral owner and an oil and gas developer, which is what the facts and Hooks were. And then facts and Hooks are also very distinguishable, because in that case, it involved a plat that was filed that allegedly contained false information. Okay, so that was the failure of constructive notice in that case, because the plat itself was false. It had information that was fraudulent. We're not dealing with that in this case, Justice Tiarina. We're dealing with a case where the royalties were filed, properly recorded with the Jim Wells County and Brooks County Property Division. There's no allegation that they were filed fraudulently. There's no allegation that any of the public records in this case were filed with any type of forgery. So that is constructive notice. And so Mr. Mon had, in our case, not only actual notice because of his knowledge of these assets and his knowledge of the fact that they were receiving income, he also had constructive notice of the mineral interests because they were duly recorded and there was no allegation that they were false. So that it's a much different fact situation than in Hooks. And the Court of Appeals in Hooks, so there was summary judgment granted. Final judgment was after jury trial resulted in a $21 million verdict. The Court of Appeals reversed and gave Hooks a take-nothing judgment. The Texas Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and found that because the Railroad Commission public records were false themselves, they were therefore inconsistent, and as a matter of law, there was a failure to exercise due diligence. Again, that is also not a breach of fiduciary duty case. I also want to point that out, which is the case we have today. We are dealing with a breach of fiduciary duty, not a fraud case.
And let me ask you, with regards to those the mineral interest, did there come a time when he started receiving royalty income from all of the producing or just a few?
I don't know the answer to that, Justice Tirina. I know in his deposition, if I recall correctly, he was absolutely receiving income from some of these. I think his testimony was that that the inventory may not have contained all of
them. Well, I asked about that. It would be interesting or helpful to the court to know how he became aware of those mineral interests, because typically if you die and you have mineral interests, you notify the companies so that they can cut new division orders and send them to all the heirs, which they would require a will with all of the beneficiaries in order to do that. And usually if you're getting from one, you get from all, because you notify the person or the oil companies that the person who owned them had died.
Right, and that's a good question. I will tell you that if you read their pleadings only address, the pleadings allege that what was not, that they did not have knowledge of and was not contained in the inventory were specific royalty interest in Jim Wells in Brooks County. Right. I took his deposition, and in his deposition he testified he was aware of those mineral interests in those specific counties. He knew his dad owned them. He knew they were generating income. So they may not have been contained in the inventory, and so that's the basis of this fraudulent concealment, but that is defeated and flies in the face of the fact that he testified under oath and in written discovery that he had knowledge of all of these assets he said he had no knowledge of. And he can't have it both ways. He can't say sister forgot to list them even though I knew about them, and say she fraudulently concealed them when they're duly recorded. That's not what the law says. He loses on both constructive notice and actual notice. And that is the due diligence that's missing in this case. I also want to, I'm only 4 minutes, so I want to talk about Berry and Justice Benavides. As we all know, you know, you wrote that opinion. That was a case involving a family ranch, and Kenneth Berry and his daughter Chelsea sued Kenneth's three brothers. I'm not going to get into the facts too much because I know this panel is aware of them. They sought damages under a breach of fiduciary duty, so it is analogous to our case. It's not. It involved other causes of action, but it did involve breach of fiduciary duty. The trial court granted statute of limitations summary judgment against Kenneth. He appealed. This court reversed the limitations, and what this court found was that the discovery rule told limitations because under Archer, deed records alone do not furnish constructive knowledge to an owner of property of subsequent impairments to title, Justice Benavides. Those are your words. We don't have that in this case. We don't have subsequent impairment of title that defeated constructive notice. These mineral interests have been the same for 40 years. They're there. They didn't change. There's no allegation that they were changed through subsequent impairment. So that is missing from this case, and therefore, I think if when you take a new lens on this case, that's something that should be considered, because I know the court, based on questioning, that they think there's some wrongdoing that the estate is somehow getting away with, and that there's some great injustice going on in this case due to some, you know, fault. That's not what we have here. And without getting into the merits, we don't have any allegation that anything was fraudulently filed, that anything was misled or forged or anything with respect to that. But then the Supreme Court and Berry held that he did, in fact, have actual and constructive notice, as the court pointed out, and the court said he knew or should have known that something was amiss with regard to the leasing arrangements for the ranch. He was aware of the lease between the parties, just like we have in our case. And similar to this case, he testified that he was aware of the mineral interests in Jim Wells in Brooks County. That's our case, excuse me. The Supreme Court held that those owed a fiduciary duty or
Berry,
not.
The Supreme Court found that as a matter of law.
Right.
He failed under due diligence, right? Am I correct?
That's right. And that case was decided on a lot of different issues. The
right.
daughter's claims survived. Kenneth's did not.
Right.
The court split that hair. We don't have that complicating factor in this case. The Supreme Court held, though, in Berry, that those owed a fiduciary duty, which would be Mark Mon, the appellant in this case, are not altogether absolved of the usual obligation to use reasonable diligence to discover an injury. When facts of misconduct become apparent, it can no longer be ignored, regardless of the nature of the relationship. So the appellant relies heavily on this brother-sister relationship. First off, they were estranged. Second off, the fact is, brothers and sisters can commit terrible acts against each other, and you should be on notice of that, especially when money's involved, and you have a due diligence to do something about it, and you can't wait 30 years, go into your dead sister's home, rummage through her things to find evidence that you think is that supports your case, which is what happened in this case. I don't want to leave here today without talking about the defects in the affidavit. We have also asserted in our brief that we felt like there's no competent summary judgment evidence, because the only evidence presented in this case to defeat summary judgment at the trial court was the affidavit. That affidavit, we filed a timely objection. The trial court overruled those objections. It still granted our motion, but overruled them. But if there's, I also think that's another way, just like the failure to plead fraud, to stop the analysis, because we objected to sham, that it was a sham affidavit, and that under the dead man's, it violated the dead man's rule, and it was not readily controvertible. As this court knows, the dead man rule generally prohibits an interested party in civil cases from testifying about oral communications of a decedent. That's briefed. I'm running close on time. It's also a sham affidavit because it contradicts his own testimony, justices. When you look at the affidavit, which is the only evidence submitted to defeat summary judgment, it controverts his own sworn testimony. I started with diligence, and I think it's appropriate to conclude with diligence. In his deposition, he testified he never requested an inventory. That's not due diligence. He never formally asked for an accounting throughout the 30 years. That's not due diligence. He never checked the Railroad Commission to confirm the mineral interests were being owed and paid. That's not due diligence. He never did anything until his sister died and he decided to go in to figure out what allegedly happened. 13,127 days lapsed between the date of death and the date of lawsuit. That's not due diligence. And I submit to the court that the trial court's judgment should be affirmed in its entirety and that this case should be dismissed. Thank you.
You have your 5 minutes, Ms. Pettis. Before we get to the merits as to whether the summary judgment was properly granted on the due diligence issue as a matter of law, do we have a pleading problem, Ms. Pettis?
I do not believe we have a pleading problem, Your Honor.
Did you plead discovery and did you plead the necessary language and the fraud for us to take into account the underlying merits of the discovery rule and due diligence?
We did not plead fraud because, again, I will assert to this court that we believe that breach of fiduciary duty is tantamount to fraud. Absolutely. We do.
Okay. What about the pleading of the discovery rule?
We didn't plead it, Your Honor, because we did not believe it was an issue. We don't have to plead it. It is a defense. It's purely a defense. We allege that our cause of action arose
when do you think your cause of action arose? I mean, you still have to plead in a pleading when the cause of action occurred and that you are and that you have filed the lawsuit within your statute of limitations.
We allege that the cause of action occurred when my client went in to clean out his sister's house after
she
passed.
That's when he discovered it. That's not when the breach occurred. So we know that the breach occurred sometime during this period. Let's assume it's longer than 4 years.
Sure.
So, because whatever alleged occurs. So you know when you're filing the lawsuit, the breach occurred longer than 4 years ago. So you know that you have a statute of limitations problems when you file this pleading. But it's been told. I mean, I know that's the argument.
Correct.
So don't you have to plead the tolling of your argument in your pleading?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe we have to. I think that is purely a defense only. We allege that the cause of action arose when we discovered the breach. The breach absolutely was going on for 30 years. Absolutely. For sure.
Okay.
But the cause of action arose when we discovered it. And I absolutely don't believe we have to plead those things, and I don't believe we have to plead fraud specifically because the case law cannot be more clear on the issue that it is tantamount to, which means equal to. Let me go into just address a few points. I only have a couple of minutes here. The Texas Supreme Court has held over and over and over again that a fiduciary's misconduct is inherently undiscoverable. That is in the SR case. That is in the Willis versus Maverick case.
Yeah, but didn't he actually, when you say that, that means that he would have no knowledge. And, but there's evidence that he had some knowledge of the existence of most of those assets.
Your Honor, like I said earlier, you are correct. He knew of the assets. He did not know where the income was going. And he had no way of objectively verifying that. He went directly to the executor. And he asked the question, what is going on with this estate? And she turned around and said, there's no money left. Nothing. I would argue that's absolutely due diligence.
But isn't the property itself, regardless of the income, if the property didn't pass to him that he knew about, then wouldn't he realize that something's amiss? Well, because the duplexes themselves, if he's complaining about the income, wouldn't he also complain about the title?
That is a fact issue of due diligence. I think that goes to the heart of the very matter here. I have a couple of estates going on right now that I'm handling where we haven't distributed property out for years and years and years for all sorts of different reasons. So, sure, could it give rise to a question? Absolutely. But here it did not. And I want to bring the court's attention.
I think the question, because does it give a right to, at that point, to trigger the due diligence?
Yeah, I mean, my point is that he knew of the property, and it never passed to him. So what difference does it make if it's making income or not?
I think it makes a tremendous.
It would have been that in itself, just the property itself not passing to me, would have been enough for me to go to the courthouse.
Maybe so, but in this case, we're talking mostly about the income. What he realized when he was cleaning out his sister's house in February of 2021 is there was a substantial amount of income that was being misappropriated and put into her personal bank account. So whether or not the properties were being distributed or not certainly is an issue. I'm not saying it isn't, but it's the income produced therefrom that we had no way of knowing. And he asked his sister specifically for that. Information, she said, there's nothing there. He had no way of objectively verifying that. I want to bring.
So, what is the disputed fact issue that the jury has to decide? Because to me, as we sat here, it doesn't seem like the facts are disputed. The analysis of it on whether that's due diligence is what is being argued. But there are no disputed facts here.
The issue is whether or not he exercised reasonable due diligence. And I want.
But isn't that's a question of law?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, and I want to point the court to the case of Energy Products Company versus Barry / Helfand, 491 Southwest 3rd, 699, Texas Supreme Court, 2016. And it very specifically states, although the date a cause of action accrues is normally a question of law, reasonable diligence is an issue of fact. That's what that case says.
I agree. It can be. I don't think that anybody here is going to argue that it can be a fact issue and it can be a law issue. The problem that I have in this case is where is the fact issue we're going to argue? I think, with that being said, I think your time is up. I'll let you finish your thought and we will take it under submission at that point.
The point, Your Honor, and I'll finish with these words, is that is precisely what we want to submit to a jury, is to consider not only my client's conduct, but the decedent's conduct, and let the jury determine whether or not he exercised reasonable due diligence within that 30-year period of time. And again, I'll say it one more time, if I might. I think this whole case turns probate law up on its upwards and downwards and backwards and forwards if we do not reverse and remand this case back to the trial court, because it puts the onus 100% on the beneficiary, not on the executor.
We have it.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be under submission. Thank you so much,
Your Honor.